You know, I think the president, you know, he and I talked, and he would like to lose over the next, I think a reasonable goal over the next year or so is to lose 10 to 15 pounds. We talked about diet and exercise a lot. He's more enthusiastic about the diet part than the exercise part, but we're going to do both. He and I will work together over the next year to incorporate a good plan so that we can meet those goals.
Dr. Ronny Jackson, President Trump's personal physician and now his nominee to replace David Shulkin as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The VA is the second largest federal agency with more than 350,000 employees. Conservatives are pushing to more aggressively privatize this massive institution, something Shulkin reportedly resisted. Where will Dr. Jackson lead the department on this and other issues that are affecting veterans care, should he make it all the way into the secretary's seat? Nikki Wendling is a reporter covering the VA for the military newspaper Stars and Stripes, and she joins me now. Welcome, Nikki.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what have you heard so far, if anything, from your sources about what they think of the president's nominee?
Sure. So Ronny Jackson is a relative unknown in the veterans community here in Washington. I spoke with some leaders of major veteran organizations last night trying to get their thoughts, and all they could basically tell me was that they don't know much about him. I think a lot of people will be looking to his confirmation hearing in the Senate to try and, you know, ascertain what he knows about the VA and what direction he wants to take it in. As far as we know right now, it doesn't look like he has experience running a large organization, and the VA is massive and bureaucratic, and there are mismanagement and miscommunication issues to deal with. Some groups I talked to said they were disappointed at the timing of Trump's decision last night, especially with his idea to bring in someone from the Defense Department who will lead the VA in this interim period while Jackson is going through the confirmation process. Joe Chenelly, he's the director of AMVETS here in D.C. He said he was highly concerned about that. You know, all these major things are happening at the VA right now to try to make it better. And he said that as of last night, he's worried that's effectively slammed to a halt.
Right. And it's all in flux. And before we get into this conversation about privatization, how should we understand the clash between the White House and Shulkin? There's this charge of the alleged unethical use of travel funds. So how much does his firing have to do with a push among conservatives for privatization?
Sure. I mean, there is this debate going on before the travel scandal. You know, this relates way back to the VA wait time scandal in 2014, even. If you remember then, it was revealed at the time that veterans couldn't get access to the VA, and there were these secret wait lists. So in response to that, Congress put in a program in place that allows veterans to go into the private sector to get care, and the VA will pay for it. So everyone agrees, you know, conservatives and Democrats, that it's flawed and that veterans need to be able to go in there more flexibly and use the private sector to change this program. But the debate here is the level to which it needs to be changed. And Shulkin has a different idea of what that should have been than some other White House appointees placed in the VA that really had Trump's ear. So that rift had already existed when the travel report came out.
Okay, so they kind of coincide. And David Shulkin wrote in his op-ed to the New York Times about this today that it's because of his successes within the VA that people who support privatization have pushed even harder. What's the consensus on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say, you know, especially among veterans here in Washington, that Shulkin did make big progress. He got through that accountability bill, if you remember last year, that allows the VA to fire its employees easier with less evidence. And a lot of people wanted that because they felt like VA employees were doing bad things and not getting punished. So Trump really liked that. I don't know if his successes really led to White House appointees feeling that they could do more, but they did have different ideas than Shulkin on what should be done, and that really created this distrust and animosity that really, really came out in the past month. And then, yeah, and then since then, it's been, you know, every day is today the day he's going to get fired. And it's from that relationship with White House appointees.
Well, as you pointed out, private contractors are already working with the VA. So what are conservatives calling for?
Sure. Yeah. So veterans can go into the private sector right now if they live more than 40 miles from a VA facility, or if it takes them longer than 30 days to get an appointment at a VA hospital or clinic. And those are hard and fast rules. So Democrats and conservatives think that those rules should be changed because it's hard for rural veterans especially to stick to those and not be able to go into the private sector. But some people in Congress and then some in the White House want the veteran to be able to choose to go into the private sector without first having to get the approval of the VA. And that's a big sticking point because if you have unfettered choice, then that's a lot of resources flying out of the VA into the private sector. And Shulkin and Democrats and some Republicans, still want to keep a healthy VA and make it better because they think a lot of veterans like to use it.
And is there a consensus on what privatization would do for the system and the health of the institution as a whole, as well as, you know, veterans' concerns about their care?
Yeah, so if more resources were to go into the private sector and it was a really aggressive push, there's a lot of concern that the vast healthcare system for veterans in this country would really erode and eventually be dismantled because everyone would be going into the private sector or think they need to go into the private sector. And that's expensive. The VA serves 9 million veterans with healthcare. 9 million. And it's unsure, will the private sector even be able to handle that amount? So there's a lot of questions, how far we should push into the private sector and what that will do to both the private sector and the VA.
And on the front line, do we know what vets want?
So vets want a lot of different things. There's a lot of veterans in this country, and they all have different ideas, especially if you talk to them about this issue. A lot of them will have opinions because it's a real touch point in the veterans community. So major veterans organizations pull their memberships, and they keep going back to Congress saying that their members want a VA healthcare system because they like going to a system that's uniquely built for them, and they have different illnesses and injuries than the rest of the population, and they really enjoy it. But then there are these veterans who also have bad experiences at a VA who want to be able to go into the private sector and get angry when people say that they shouldn't have that option.
Nikki Wendling, she's VA reporter for military newspaper Stars and Stripes. Excuse me, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there's a new wave of veterans running for office in 2018, supported by groups like Serve America PAC, who produced this promotional video.
I served three tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I was the first woman Marine to fly in an F-18 in combat.
I served two combat tours in Iraq before returning home to teach math to students in underserved communities.
I served with Teach for America and led the educational nonprofit Springboard.
But one thing sets these veterans apart who are running for office. A large number of them are running as Democrats in districts that typically go red. So could this be the key to the party reclaiming the House in 2018? Michael Cruz is on the line to tell us more about this. He's been covering the story for Politico. Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. I hope you're well, too. How many vets, is my question, are running as Democrats in 2018? And are there more Democratic vets than Republicans?
So according to With Honor, which is a bipartisan organization that, based on my reporting, has done the most rigorous count, there are or have been 300 or so veterans running in the 2018 cycle. And slightly more than half of those veterans, they put the number at 51%, are Democrats. So this number is sort of ever-changing overall, and Democrats, because there are primaries and candidates dropped in and out, but I think there is a broad agreement, not just by With Honor, but many similar organizations and political strategists and thinkers in and around Washington, that this number is higher than it has been, significantly higher than it has been, both overall and certainly with respect to Democrats in this cycle relative to prior cycles in the last couple decades.
Right. And as you write in your reporting, that a lot of these candidates are also pretty young. They're millennials, and they were inspired to enlist after 9/11. They served in Iraq and Afghanistan. What do you think the draw is in that background to voters in the current political climate? Is there true crossover appeal there?
The draw to the voters as opposed to the candidates?
To the voters, yeah.
The voters. I think there is or can be crossover appeal. This is what has some Democratic candidates and strategists excited about this, because you have the portion of voters that are going to vote Democrat, even in these districts where a Republican holds the seat at this point. But there is this not insignificant middle portion that is searching for a home right now with all of the political upheaval. And one possible answer, or an answer that Democrats hope is an answer, is to have a young veteran show up at your door or show up on your TV and present a new kind of face, a response of sorts to what is happening in the White House, but even beyond what is happening in the White House, what is happening and has been happening for the last, decade plus on Capitol Hill, just the incredible and incredibly dispiriting gridlock, hyper-partisanship, and the notion here from these candidates and from the strategists behind them is that this presents an alternative and a hope that veterans, particularly young veterans, could work across the aisle and could just make things move better on Capitol Hill.
How did you see that play out? Because you followed a young man named Max Rose, who's running for Congress in a Republican-leaning district in Staten Island, where about 60% voted for Trump in 2016. So what was it like watching him walk around the neighborhood, knocking on doors and talking to voters? How did people respond to him?
A really interesting district, the only congressional district in New York City that went for Trump, currently held by a Republican. Max Rose is a 31-year-old, highly educated, went to Wesleyan, went to London School of Economics, served in Iraq after enlisting, was injured over there. And he, as I observed on two separate occasions, two separate days earlier this month, went door knocking, and the conversations were very similar. You know, the door sort of opened a little bit more when they heard about his experiences. First, his status as a veteran, as a young veteran, a post 9/11 veteran, and then the fact that he was a Democrat makes him an interesting package that literally New York City has not seen. He is, as he says to almost everybody he encounters, he is the first post 9/11 veteran, Republican or Democrat, to run for office in New York City.
So Democrats, they really are hoping this is the key to 2018. Are they right?
Well, to be determined. It's certainly in play. It's part of the plan, to the extent that there is a plan to see how they might be able to reclaim control in the House. But I do think in Max's situation, it is a far from a sure thing, but it is a winnable, flippable district, and there are a variety of other candidates, some of whom I've quoted also in this piece, who could be in similar situations. And you all add that up, and you could start getting to the couple dozen districts that Democrats need to flip to regain control of the House.
Thanks for this, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Cruz, he's a staff writer for Politico, where you can read his article on how veterans are powering the Democrats' hopes for 2018. Thanks again. Coming up, the opioid crisis and its unintended side effects. Patients with chronic and post-op pain are having a harder time getting meds when the cure to one ill creates a whole other wellspring of suffering. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. The opioid crisis gets a lot of coverage, and rightly so, and the narrative is pretty well established. Drug companies encouraged doctors to prescribe more pain pills. They did, and the patients wanted them. Some patients got hooked, and many of them moved on to heroin and other street drugs to feed their habits. Well, a piece in the April edition of Harper's Magazine focuses on another side of opioids, the people suffering from chronic pain who rely on them to function, and the impact of the crisis and subsequent crackdown on these patients. Brian Goldstone, a journalist and anthropologist, is the author of that Harper's piece, and he joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
So for this piece, you spent time with a guy named Austin Sell. Why don't you tell us who he is and how he first got prescribed opioids?
Sure. So Austin is an African-American, single father of three, living in Great Falls, Montana. He has been suffering from severe spinal pain since he was a child, has tried pretty much every treatment accessible to him. Some of these treatments helped a bit, some only made it worse. Unfortunately, the ones that helped were often the most expensive, or the insurance would only cover, you know, a certain number of physical therapy sessions. But finally, about 4 years ago, he met a physician assistant who, you know, in Austin's words, finally took his pain seriously and saw it as really impacting his entire life, his ability to be a father, to provide for his family. And Rod Lutz, this physician assistant, decided that a carefully overseen drug regimen of an opioid called Opana might be beneficial for him.
And what effect, once he started taking the drugs, did they have on his life and ability to function?
Well, you know, at first there were some unpleasant side effects, and he worked with his provider to find a dosage that worked for him. And once he did, the benefits were pretty dramatic and immediate. He was able to return to work as a sales clerk at JCPenney. He was able to, you know, be a parent again, be a father to his kids, and he even decided to go back to school to become a physician assistant. He wanted to kind of, you know, pay it forward by giving other chronic pain sufferers the care that he was receiving.
And briefly, what did Sell experience then when the crackdown on prescription opioids got going full force?
Yeah, well, he showed up one day to an appointment at this pain clinic and was told that his provider had been fired and that the first order of business was to reduce his medication. It's generally recommended that you do a very, very slow taper off of these opioid medication. But in his case, they decided to cut his dosage by 80% immediately. They apologized. They said that a new federal guideline mandated what they called speed limit on what could be prescribed. And that was that. By the time I met him a few months later, his world had kind of, you know, crumbled around him.
And did he suffer all of the symptoms of withdrawal? And is that what the people around him thought happened? And I'm thinking that one of the things you point out in your piece is that this is what the media gets wrong about the epidemic, that withdrawal, which many patients are going to experience, isn't an actual sign of addiction.
Absolutely. So in his case, the withdrawal was a nightmare. You know, it's like you take the worst pain imaginable, and then you add on top of that these withdrawal symptoms, which are notoriously excruciating, vomiting, nausea, fever, chills, and so they were awful. And in a kind of perverse way, that was like a confirmation to the clinic, and it has been a confirmation sort of publicly in terms of the national narrative around the opioid epidemic, that these patients are addicts. And that's just a misunderstanding of the way that these drugs interact with the body. Anyone who takes opioid medication for an extended period of time, even a cancer patient, will develop a physical dependence, and withdrawal will likely ensue once they're taken away.
How representative, though, is Austin Sell's experience? First of all, you know, they're going to be casualties of any reaction to a crisis, for sure, sadly. But how many people are there like Sell across the country? And was this just a case of one clinic handling these new restrictions and regulations badly, like one bad apple?
Yeah, I think that's something that was very striking to me in reporting this story, which is that as egregious and callous as this seems, and what he was subjected to seems, it's actually quite representative of what's happening across the country. If you spend any time on chronic pain forums online or visit the comment sections of most articles written about the opioid crisis, you hear testimony after testimony of people suffering the same kind of, I don't think abandonment is too strong a word.
Well, what about doctors? How concerned are they about being able to treat pain effectively? And you mentioned that the physician's assistant who was treating cells was fired summarily.
Yeah, I think the reaction has been, let's just opt out of the entire conversation about opioids. I don't want to deal with them. I don't want to touch them. And in some cases, that has meant I don't even want to deal with chronic pain patients because it's so complicated, you know, what they're going through. And, you know, the work required to sort of monitor these medications has become so challenging for physicians that they just kind of want to step away from the entire issue. And that has left these patients often with no other options.
Well, who's speaking to the future of this reform in the opioid crisis? Does the CDC have any recommendations for how doctors or hospitals should be doing?
Well, actually, it was the CDC guideline that came out in 2016 that kind of got the ball rolling on a lot of these problems that we're now seeing. This guideline has been kind of applied in a very haphazard and kind of across the board way. And these upper limits on dosages have been mandated in all kinds of medical settings, even at a pain clinic like this one in Montana. So this federal guideline that was invoked in cutting Austin's cell off of his medication was the CDC guideline. And that was a mistaken application of this guideline. But the CDC sadly, has made little public effort to correct this misperception.
How is Sel now?
He's still struggling to get his life together. He's been unable to find another pain clinic that will take him on. Nobody wants to touch a patient who has had issues with another clinic. They're sort of blacklisted.
Brian, thank you for this story. Thanks for all the work you did on it. And thanks for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Brian Goldstone, he's a journalist and anthropologist and contributor to Harper's Magazine. His article, The Pain Refugees, is in the current issue of Harper's. Coming up, the story of women showrunners in television sometimes seems like one long tale of the same battles being fought over and over again, from Roseanne to Shonda Rhimes to Amy Sherman-Palladino.
Even on Gilmore Girls, I think at one point she said executives kept calling her and she finally just said, look, you're not my mother, so either stop calling me or fire me.
Joy Press on her new book, Stealing the Show, How Women Revolutionized Television. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand.
Well, I'm fit.
Yeah, right. And I'm the World Boxing Council lightweight champion.
Well, I'll snap your spine in half like a potato chip, you.
You know where I'm going, Mom?
Disneyland.
Nope.
Puppy World.
You're so immature, you're gonna make me say it?
Say what?
I am on my way to Friday night dinner.
Ah, that's right. You're on the road to hell, Bill.
If I'm sleeping, don't wake me unless your patient is actually dying. Rule number 4, the dying patient better not be dead when I get there. Not only will you have killed someone, you would have woke me for no good reason. We clear?
From Roseanne to Gilmore Girls and Grey's Anatomy, women showrunners like Roseanne Barr, Amy Sherman-Palladino, and Shonda Rhimes have changed the TV industry over the past three decades. A new book looks at how they've fought for creative control, struggled with being liked, and introduced more nuanced characters and stories. It's called Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television, and it's written by the former television critic for The Village Voice and former LA Times editor, Joy Press. And Joy, it's so great you could come in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you begin this story, even though I could talk for about 4 hours about That Girl with Marlo Thomas, you do begin the story for real with the sitcoms Roseanne and Murphy Brown. And they both started in 1988. And why don't we talk about Murphy Brown first? And just to remind everyone who might not remember this show, Diane English was the showrunner. She created it and ran the show. And she built the show around a crotchety, ball-breaking 40-year-old journalist fresh out of rehab. So here's Murphy Brown in a scene with her perky colleague, Corky.
Isn't this a hoot? Can you believe it?
Corky, you remember that memo I sent out last week, the one about how no one should talk to me in the morning until after 3 o'clock?
Oh, Murphy, you're such a kidder. What a hoot!
Diane English, didn't she say that she saw Murphy Brown as like living like a man and making no apologies for it whatsoever, and like Mike Wallace in a dress?
Yes, Mike Wallace in a dress is quite an image.
Yeah, for the ages, right. Well, what did her male executive bosses think of this female lead?
My understanding is that they were looking for a kind of younger actress. I think Heather Locklear's name was mentioned. She was at the time a sort of nubile blonde, probably in her late 20s, early 30s. And they were really disturbed by this idea of Murphy as a sort of recovering alcoholic. I mean, Murphy, you know, was a real troublemaker. She had gotten thrown out of the White House. I think she was, you know, banned from all kinds of public functions.
Right. She wouldn't reveal her source. And she had gotten around, Murphy had. She'd slept around. And,
she was a really, really tough.
Rabble rouser.
Yeah. And she was a tough investigative journalist. And so I think originally the network wanted her to be coming back from a spa visit as opposed to rehab. But there was a
like
writer's...
Like a Charlie's Angel.
Exactly. You know, just getting her skin refreshed. But there was a writer's strike, so they had to make a choice. They couldn't redo the script. And so it was a choice between taking Murphy as an older, tough-as-nails, recovering addict or wait until the strike was over. And so Murphy Brown got on air, you know, flaws
and all. Semi-accidentally, it sounds like, through a back door.
Yeah.
Well, that explains a lot. Because later on, Murphy Brown, she gets pregnant in a one-night stand with her ex-husband and actually considered not keeping the baby. That was, the third season? So this is turn of 89, 90.
Right.
And suddenly, that was a season cliffhanger, and Murphy Brown became a touchpoint in the 1980s war over family values. Did Diane English intend to cause that kind of political firestorm that ensued?
Well, she says that she didn't. And she told me that she was inspired by, she went to a friend's office in New York, I think it was a magazine editor who had just had a baby. And she actually was sort of keeping the, you know, little baby in her desk drawer. I mean, I assume the drawer was open and, you know, there was bunting in it. But she just loved this idea that of a strong working woman trying to kind of work this baby into her schedule. I think she thought it had a lot of comedic possibilities.
So she didn't know what was coming at her.
She really did not know what was coming at her. I think by the time the pregnancy happened, it was, you know, clear there was maybe going to be a little bit of tension because the culture wars of that time, that was a very polarized political environment, just a little bit like the one we have today.
I know, a little bit deja vu, I think, is
definitely deja vu. And and so, you know, there was a huge wave of kind of religious right-wing focus on family values and anti-contraception, you know, real sort of battle against, you know, women's reproductive rights. So Murphy Brown having this, you know, very well-to-do but single working woman decide to have a baby, not to, you know, have an abortion or give it up for adoption, but to have this baby, ended up causing a huge kind of circus in the culture.
Which Dan Quayle stepped into.
Yes, the vice president at the time decided for reasons known only to himself, to make this fictional character the center of a speech about family values and basically sort of accused Murphy Brown of ruining the American family. And rather than backing down off of that, he ended up doubling down, and it became the kind of centerpiece of, you know, Bush's reelection campaign against Bill Clinton.
It's interesting to hear Diane English. She told you that this was a really scary time for her, that there were death threats, right?
There were death threats. I mean, I think she had to get guards. And yet she and the show and the network sort of doubled down behind Murphy. And it actually, they incorporated it into the plot, you know, so that Murphy was actually addressing real life kind of news shows, nightly news broadcasts on the show as if, you know, it were happening in the real world of TV.
Right. And program. I think, and there was a Dan Quayle joke in every episode, they realized, at least one. And meanwhile, it's really interesting how you compare and contrast what was going on in 1988. Meanwhile, over at ABC, Roseanne was breaking all sorts of taboos in a different way. Just to remind everyone again, Roseanne, who is back in a reboot, so maybe you don't need reminding, but Roseanne was about a working class woman dealing with real life issues, marriage and kids. And in your interview with her, she told you about growing up with her Lithuanian Jewish grandmother who ran an apartment building full of people who had fled the Nazis. And this is what made her a comedian?
She had a very interesting and I think fairly traumatic childhood. And she kind of grew up in this environment, ended up becoming a stand-up comedian, kind of coming out of her becoming a feminist.
And her show was just infamously chaotic behind the scenes. Did she really post a declaration of war on her door?
She had a declaration of war in capital letters basically saying, you know, I am the boss. And if you don't listen to me, then, you know, when I have control, you're all going to be gone. And initially, the conflict was she was an outsider. She had no Hollywood experience. And she wanted to create this very real character that resembled herself in part and people that she knew.
Right. She had a very principled vision.
She had an incredibly strong vision, and she didn't, you know, she wasn't tactful about it. And she had people who were sort of co-creating it with her who were saying, I don't think the character you want to create is something people in America want to see. I don't think she's very likable. I don't, you know.
Well, likable. This word comes up over and over and over again. And it comes up with New Girl's Zooey Deschanel face that. And here we have Amy Schumer and Lena Dunham. They're still making comedy out of that straitjacket. So is that the, do you think that's the significance of the Roseanne story in this larger story of women in television?
That's part of the Roseanne story. I think Roseanne brought so many new things to television. I mean, I think she was kind of a class warrior. I think she was an incredibly unorthodox leading lady. I mean, you look at Lucille Ball. She was hilarious, right?
But she was thin and beautiful.
Yeah. She had been a movie star. And, you know, Roseanne was absolutely nothing like anybody we had seen in a lead role. Just even down to her voice, you know, which was very shrill. She just was so vehement about everything, but she was also lovable. And you still see that, you know, the show's back.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Joy Press. She has a new book about the history of women showrunners in television. It's called Stealing the Show. We're just talking about Roseanne, the first iteration of Roseanne, not this reboot that premiered this week. Apparently, big names came out of her writer's room from back then, Joss Whedon, and specifically Amy Sherman-Palladino, who you talked to for the book. She was the showrunner for Gilmore Girls. We heard a clip earlier. And she also is the showrunner for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which won several Golden Globes. And she told you that writing for Roseanne was both the best and the worst thing that could have happened for her.
I think that Roseanne was a really amazing and devastating first place to work because Roseanne, by fighting so hard and actually by the show being as immediately successful as it was, Roseanne basically banned executives from the set. As long as the show was doing well, that pretty much worked. So Amy Sherman-Palladino got to work. She was then Amy Sherman, got to work in a workplace full of fantastically talented people who were not sort of constantly given notes, as often happens in network television. It's a very collaborative process. Of course, many of those notes are helpful to making a TV show. But
Amy Sherman-Palladino learned to have this sort of monomaniacal vision about a show, a kind of auteur's vision. And so when Amy Sherman-Palladino then got to do her own shows, she had some shows on network television after Roseanne that, you know, she found incredibly frustrating because people are always bothering her and interfering and trying to sort of rein her in. And even on Gilmore Girls, I think at one point she said executives kept calling her and she finally just said, look, you're not my mother, so either stop calling me or fire me.
If only we could all stand up.
Yes, I don't think very many people survive by doing that on television, but she has lived to tell the tale.
Well, let's talk about Shonda Rhimes and Shondaland. Just a huge presence in television. She's the showrunner for Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and Private Practice, and has done films. But in terms of the story that you're telling, I thought about the end of Grey's Anatomy, in which the Sandra Oh character, one of the leads, she leaves her lover and she goes off to run a hospital in Switzerland. And I remember watching that thinking, oh, that is so great. I am so glad she chose career over love. But then I read in your book that the audience was really upset about it.
You're offering me your hospital. Like you're Willy Wonka and you're handing me a chocolate factory.
Cheer up, Charlie.
You're not serious. You are serious.
Grey's Anatomy was so interesting because, you know, it's sort of in this like melodrama format, but so much of it was about these characters carving out space to do what they wanted in their lives. And they were, from the very first episode, these female characters were so ambitious. And I think that Christina, that character, was very much a kind of alter ego for Shonda Rhimes. And she said that when she was trying to come up with an ending, she felt that that was the perfect happy ending, was that she gets this perfect job. And she was really surprised and kind of upset to find a lot of viewers couldn't see that as a happy ending.
And this is a dizzying thing, looking at this history that you've written of television, whether it's a mirror of our culture or whether it moves culture forward. That's always the question about art and television. And I'm thinking back to That Girl, that show that I remember from the 60s, where the end of that series, Marlo Thomas, the lead, they wanted her to marry her completely sexless walking Ken doll of a boyfriend. But she said, no, I want the series to end of me taking him to a woman's lib meeting.
Which is an incredible moment. And that happened because Marlo Thomas asserted herself. And
but what's changed in 50 years? It's dizzying.
It's two steps forward and one step back, or maybe one and a half.
Well, I mean, we could look at it from this point of view, that one of the other big questions when it comes to women in television is whether women run businesses in any workplace, but especially in television, whether women run a more humane or worker-supportive shop. And is that what you've seen in a place like Shondaland and with the other showrunners that you've tracked?
My sense is that when women have actual power, they do attempt to run a more humane workplace in terms of being more open to childcare on site and that kind of thing, and also tend to run a more diverse writer's room. There's certainly been, in the last 5 years, a huge sort of attempt to bring in more women rather than so many of these women came up through the business being the only woman in the room. TV shows are written usually by committee, in a sense. And
right. They didn't know each other. You talked to a whole bunch of writers who were the only woman in the room.
Yeah. A couple of older women writers said to me, you know, we're getting to know each other now. Because we were like the one, you know, every room wanted to have like a woman. So maybe to write the female characters or so they consult with them. So it didn't look bad that they didn't have a single woman. So now there's a real effort to just make it a little bit more even handed. Some rooms are even 2/3 women or, you know, one or two are all women now.
On the other hand, women are still vastly underrepresented as showrunners and screenwriters, as you're pointing out, and directors in TV and film, and the political climate is not exactly female-friendly. So where do women stand relative to men in the industry right now? And is there still this bias that you call peak vagina? And you should explain what that is.
Yes. Peak vagina, isn't that a great expression? I think that that actually happened because there was a spate of shows in, I think, 2010, 2011, 2012. So you had sort of Girls and New Girl and Two Broke Girls, a lot of girls. And one of the creators of Two and a Half Men, I think, said, oh, my God, you know, we've hit peak vagina. Enough already. You know, three or four shows about women created by women was peak vagina.
His head must be exploding now.
I think so. We might have to send a search party for pieces of his body. But I think that it's a very weird thing because anecdotally, things have improved a great deal. But the numbers don't look good.
Well,
they
no.
still are terrible.
And, you know, then you look at something like the star of The Crown, Claire Foy, got paid so much less than her colleague Matt Smith, who played Prince Philip.
Yes, the playing ground is absolutely not even. But I do think, particularly in the wake of Me Too, Hollywood at least can no longer say that they didn't know or that it's not happening. There is a sort of onus on the industry to try to figure out some systemic fixes for this really uneven playing ground.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about those fixes. Maybe not right today. Thank you so much, Joy.
Thanks, Barb.
Joy Press, she's the author of Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. Thanks again. And it's so nice to have Warren Olney here to tell us what's coming up on your podcast.
Oh, so nice to be here. Thank you so much for the introduction. Now, we're going to be talking today. You know, the primary elections are underway, and it is we can't talk often enough about what the prospects are. Will the Russians still be messing around with the results? Will they be rigged in some sense? Will people believe that they are? Is there confidence in the process? We'll be talking about that. And what needs to be done? What can the media do? What can politicians do to try to restore some sort of credibility to the process? And we'll also talk with Michael Rich, who's the president and CEO of RAND Corporation, very powerful think tank, of course. And he'll be talking about his new study called Truth Decay. It is sort of goes beyond the idea of fake news, and it's a very interesting way of looking at what we face in terms of what is available, what you can believe, what you can't believe. Truth Decay. Isn't that a great title?
I love that. The global erosion of values, in fact.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that.
All
Everyone
right.
tune in to the To The Point podcast. Coming up on our show, happy opening day of baseball. It's a great day for fans and players, unless maybe if you're in the minor leagues. Minor league players are suing the MLB because they make below the minimum wage, and oddly, their case is getting undercut, perhaps, by a provision in the new government spending bill. That's all next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand.
Let's go! Batter up! We're taking the afternoon off. It's a beautiful day for a ball game. For a ball game today.
A little retro opening day music for you today as Major League Baseball gets its season underway. Maybe crack open a cold one to get in the mood. But opening day also means the start of a long, hard slog for another part of baseball. Down in the minor leagues, players are often barely scraping by financially. Some make as little as $3,000 for a whole season. Players have filed a lawsuit to change that, but a little notice provision in the recent spending bill makes it very unlikely to succeed. Mary Pallon wrote about this for The New Yorker, and great of you to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're talking about a part of the bill called the Save America America's Pastime Act. What is that?
Yes. Yeah, so I was among those who was surprised to learn about this a couple of weeks ago. So basically, this is a provision. It's on page 1967, in case you didn't read, that basically would kind of solidify, among other things, it would kind of solidify baseball's antitrust provision. So the language, which is really wonky, but I'll paraphrase a little bit, is that minor league players would get a $60 raise. Currently, they make about $1,100 a month for 6 months. So now under the bill, it would be $1,160. So not exactly the raise I think the players were hoping for.
And look, why is it in the spending bill in the first place?
So this has been a battle that's been going on for a long time between professional baseball and the minor league players. And the reason I heard about it is I first wrote about it back in 2015. It has a fascinating backstory. There's this man named Garrett Brocius, who is a former minor league pitcher himself, who then went to law school and became a lawyer. And he is representing, I believe, you know, maybe more than 2,000 minor league players at this time. He's trying to get in a class action against baseball, arguing that they're not being paid fairly and that, doing the math, most minor league baseball players are actually making less than minimum wage. And, you know, basically says that they're being exploited. So,
and now
baseball
they're
obviously
suing.
Been pushing back on that.
Yeah, they're suing. But it would seem that this federal provision is kind of an end run around them, right?
It's really hard to say. You know, I'm not a lawyer and it's unclear, but I think what was really surprising about it to folks watching, you know, from the minor league player side was that it was in the spending bill at all and the process or lack thereof. It seems like most of the people I talked to heard about it when it was first reported, you know, whether it was in the Washington Post or, you know, drafts of the bill that are rumors that were being circulated, which I thought was really fascinating. I mean, normally when you think about a piece of government policy, and I'm not a beat DC reporter, but the criticism is usually the opposite, that there are these long hearings and there's, you know, it takes forever. And by all accounts, this was kind of tucked in. And, you know, as we kind of all watched, you know, the spending bill kind of was passed through and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. So I think baseball is one of many things that people were surprised was in there. But that was one of the big complaints I heard. It wasn't so much that this was in there, but they felt like they weren't in the process. And so we'll see what, if any, impact it could have on the lawsuit.
Well, what's the MLB justification for such depressed pay and the inclusion of this federal provision? And I noticed that you snuck a peek at the talking points from major league lobbyists. What did they say?
So baseball, and some of this is kind of almost public, right? They've talked about it a little bit and it's come up in the lawsuit. And it's not surprising that, you know, baseball is active on the Hill, right? The NFL, the NBA, all these major leagues have a presence in Washington. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, they're multi-million, if not billion-dollar organizations that touch a lot of aspects of American life. But they've argued that minor league baseball is not a career, that the majors are propping up the minors. You know, you have smaller crowds. You don't have the same TV rights situation. They've also argued that minor league players in some cases may receive bonuses. Obviously, the minor league players push back on that. One of the things I thought was interesting about their arguments, it really echoed to me a lot of the debates going on with the NCAA and this question of how, you know, should we pay college athletes? And if so, how much and what's appropriate? And, you know, when does the NCAA act as a farm system for, you know, basketball or football or these other sports? And so with minor league baseball, you have kind of it's not totally analogous, but you do have another setup where you have a farm system, in this case, quite literally, to the pro teams. And, you know, by definition, not everybody's going to make it to the pros. But this is still a pretty serious time commitment these players are putting in. And, you know, minor league baseball, if you're playing for a minor team, it's not just like, you know, another hobby or going to the gym. It's a very unique lifestyle, I think any player would tell you. So you have these broader forces that are being debated. And that's why I'm so curious to see how this all works out, because it could set the tone, I think, for how a lot of pro leagues and amateur leagues and development leagues kind of look at how to legislate around this.
Well, you just said a lot of them don't make it to the major leagues. And I can't imagine people are listening to this and they're thinking, look, minor leagues, it's just a way station for players heading to the big bucks. You know, why should I care what they make on their road to becoming millionaires?
That's a great question and a great point. point. But I do think that what the minor league players keep arguing is that it's minimum wage. It's federal minimum wage. And the general idea is that in this country, there's a minimum wage, you know, that exists for a reason. And so one of the things that's interesting about this, too, to me is that sports, as much as unions have, you know, been on the decline in this country, sports is an area where they're still really robust and strong. And baseball is no exception. And one of the things that the minor league players have said is that they're not represented by a union. So they don't have somebody negotiating a minimum pay, a minimum set of you know, benefits or agreement about what the workplace should look like. And this is far from a conventional workplace. You have this very traditional law that is ubiquitous in workplaces, right, up against sports. And one of the arguments I've heard from minor league players is that when you go to see a minor league game, you know, the bat boy in some cases making more than the players, or the person working in the concession stands or selling you peanuts, which I think to most fans, and I count myself among, I grew up watching minor league baseball more than pro, was really surprising.
That really puts a face on it. Thank you so much. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
Mary Pallon writes for The New Yorker and is the author of the book, The Kevin Show. And that's it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave. I'll see you tomorrow.